The following is a recording of the Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. We are located in Collegeville, Pennsylvania. We are also located on the web at www.tpuuf.org. Please come visit us.
To Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship, we're so glad you were able to join us. We are located in Collegeville, Pennsylvania, but this morning we are as close to you as your own home. We are a Unitarian Universalist congregation dedicated to nurturing the spirit and transforming the world. Whoever you are in you and wherever you are on your spiritual journey or your life journey, we welcome you. Whomever you love, whatever your gender or gender expression, we welcome you. Into this ever-growing circle of love, compassion, and justice. This morning, our service focuses on holding our center in times of overwhelm. And I want to begin with an opening reading. The reading comes from a book by the medical doctor, Rachel Naomi Raymond, in her book, Kitchen Table Wisdom. Stories that heal. She writes, I suspect that the most basic, powerful way to connect with another person is to listen. Just listen. Perhaps the most important thing we ever give each other is our attention, and especially if it's from the heart. When people are talking, there's no need to do anything but receive them. Just take them in, listen to what they're saying, care about it. Most times, caring about it is even more important than understanding it. The places in which we are seen and heard are holy places. They remind us of our value as human beings. They give us strength to go on. I'm the Reverend Larry Piers, the minister at Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. And I welcome you to this service. Now, Amy Nabet will light our chalice.
Prepare to hear these words by the Universalist Reverend Dr. Gordon McKeeman, whom many called Bucky. He lived for 93 years and had a long, meaningful ministry. Deep calls us unto deep. Joy calls unto joy. Light calls unto light. Let the kindling of this flame rekindle in us the inner light of love, of peace, of hope. As one flame lights another, nor grows the less, we pledge ourselves to be bearers of the light wherever we go. And now Preston Lutwiler will light the peace lamp.
After I light the peace lamp, your response will be, and with all the people of the world. May peace be with you, and with all the people of the world.
So our gathering song this morning is Sanctuary, and it's performed by Christine and David Perry. And the lyrics will appear on the screen in the moment. Please join in when you're ready.
Right through. thanksgiving, we are a living sanctuary anew.
Our reading is a poem entitled The Guest House by Persian poet, the one we know as Rumi. This being human is a guest house. Every morning a new arrival, a joy, a depression, a meanness, some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. Welcome and entertain them all, even if they're a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your house empty of its furniture. Still treat each guest honorably. He may be clearing you out for some new delight. The dark thought, the shame, the malice, meet them at the door laughing and invite them in. Be grateful for whoever comes because each has been sent as a guide from beyond. Jalaluddin Rumi, translation by Coleman Barks.
So my conversation through story this morning is about the kitchen table in the family of my household. For me, the kitchen table in my home growing up was a sacred and holy place, a place of centering. It's a place where I could show up no matter what I was feeling or thinking or what I had experienced. And oftentimes my mother, my father, my stepfather, depending on what time of my life, would be there and to kind of listen and companion one another. This was the place where I heard the stories that my mother would tell me consistently about some of the struggles of her life growing up in Italy during World War II and some of the other struggles and challenges that she had faced in her life. And it was like a nurturing that I was getting through this. As a matter of fact, oftentimes food was involved. I remember once my mother, more than once, my mother would make me a milkshake and put an egg in it and malt, give it to me, and she'd say, Lottie, you're so skinny. Well, it's true. I was very skinny back then. And so those were nurturing times. They were places where I felt like my mother would often try to lure me out of my own shyness and begin to have me talk about things that otherwise I might not talk about. My father, my stepfather, I remember sitting with him at the table once when he was telling me about the facts of life, and I could see how nervous he was as he opened up a beer, and I let him stay in his nervousness probably a little longer than I should because I pretended I didn't know anything about what he was talking about. It was a place for gathering for meals. And for us at our home, there was a kind of honoring and respecting of meal times. Whatever had happened before the meal, when we came to the table, there was a kind of a silence and a respect and a gratitude. I don't mean 100% of the time, but there was this sense of like, we're gathered here. This is a holy time for eating and for sharing and so forth. It was a place where we invited neighbors and friends and offered them a glass of iced tea or lemonade. It was a place where we could listen deeply to each other and to one another's experiences. I love the reading that Amy just read from Rumi because it reminds me that we need places like kitchen tables in our life where all the different parts of ourself can show up, where all the different people in our lives can show up, and each can be welcomed to that place because there is a place at the table for them. So as we watch this short video, I want you to think about this metaphorical kitchen table in your own life and think about the parts of yourself that you want to invite to that table, the part of you that experiences joy, the part of you that feels stress, the part of you that is overwhelmed, and the part of you that feels ambitious or whatever it is. Invite them to this, the parts of yourself, to this metaphorical table, and imagine who else you would want to invite to this table for times of deeper conversation. So let's watch this video and imagine us inviting the different parts of ourselves and others. So the reading I want to share with you this morning was written by Bucky McKeeman, who also wrote our chalice reading that Amy did this morning. I had the good fortune of knowing Bucky, as many of us called him. He's kind of one of those figures who casts a long shadow within our Unitarian and Universalist movement. And he held up a particular kind of quality that I think comes through in this reading that I want to share with you. I also want to say, when he uses the word ministry, the way I understand that is ministry is what we all do. It's our way of being in the world and being with one another. And as a minister, I share in that ministry with you. My role is to hopefully encourage and support and inspire you in the ministry that you do in all the crossroads and all the places that your life intersects with others. So here are some of the qualities of the ministry that we all share, by Bucky McKeeman. Ministry is a quality of relationship between and among human beings that beckons forth hidden possibilities. Inviting people into deeper, more constant, more reverent relationship with the world and with one another. Carrying forward a long heritage of hope and liberation that has dignified and informed the human venture over many centuries. Being present with, to, and for others in their terrors and torments, in their grief, their misery, and their pain. Knowing that those feelings are our feelings too. Celebrating the triumphs of the human spirit, the miracles of birth and life, the wonders of devotion and sacrifice. Witnessing to life-enhancing values, speaking truth to power, standing for human dignity and equity, for compassion and aspiration, believing in life in the presence of death, struggling for human responsibility against principalities and structures that ignore humanness and become instruments of death. It is all these and much, much more than all of them, present in wordless, the unspokenable, the unspoken, the ineffable. It is speaking and living the highest we know, and living with the knowledge that it is never as deep or as wide or as high as we wish. Wherever there is a meeting that summons us to our better selves, wherever our lostness is found, our fragments are united, or our wounds begin healing, our spines stiffen, and our muscles grow strong for the task, there is ministry. So during this musical meditation, let's reflect on the ways that we have received ministry from one another and from others. Let's reflect on the ways that we all do these kinds of acts of ministry in the world. So as I read that list of what ministry involves by Bucky McKeeman, I thought to myself, gosh, if our to-do list is not long enough already, we can add all of these things to our daily life and our daily practices. So I saw this New Yorker cartoon recently in which two men were stranded on this deserted island in the middle of nowhere, oceans, miles and miles of oceans surrounding them. And one of the men was standing at the edge of the island, looking longingly into the horizon with his hand over his brow and searching in desperation. And the other man was sitting luxuriously with his back against the one coconut tree that existed on that little island. And he was gesturing with his hand and saying, well, on the plus side, we won't have to listen to the news for the next 4 years. So I suspect that we're all stranded in some way during this pandemic. Some of us are actually stranded, and some of us are feeling more stranded than others. Maybe we find ourselves identifying with one or more of these characters. Some of us may feel like we're that character who is ruminating and bemoaning what is occurring and trying to orient ourselves to this crisis that none of us could have known was on its way. And we could not fully prepare ourselves emotionally and spiritually to prepare and to endure it. And maybe some of us are identifying with the other character who's just resigned to the situation. And we, like that character, might be saying to ourselves and to others similar sentences like, well, on the plus side, there's this. So depending on the hour or the day, I kind of fluctuate from one character to the other. You know, sometimes I'm more that despairing voice within myself, and I'm aware of that. And sometimes I'm looking for what might be hopeful or possible during this time. So whether we are despairing and squinting towards the horizon of time for some silver lining in this mess, the fact of the matter is we're in a time of overwhelm, a time that puts a demand on our personal, our spiritual, and our collective capacities as human beings and as a society. Now, we each adapt in different ways. Some of us get busy. Some of us cherish the freedom of fewer obligations and meetings and expectations, and others of us are numbed or hyper-focused on news or on desperate kinds of reports coming from health departments and so forth. Others of us are focusing on house cleaning that never seems to end or on politics. So the variation of these responses got really clear to me this week when I had a meeting with this team, this project team that I've been working on, and we were trying to figure out what to do next in terms of the schedule that we had planned for next year, the kind of meetings that we had planned with people that we were bringing in from around a region. And we're trying to figure out how to adapt our plans and our activities because of this uncertainty and this ever-changing uncertainty of the pandemic. In the course of the congregation, one of the persons, a professor, mind you, said, I'm enjoying all of this time alone. I love not actually having to meet with people. And others chimed in a similar kind of way. And I sat there, watching them, my jaw kind of dropped, and I kind of felt alone with the feeling that I was experiencing, but I expressed it anyway. I said, I'm feeling a kind of grief that I can't actually put into words. It's a current grief for all the diminished kinds of interactions that we could or used to have, and it's also an anticipatory grief for all the repercussions of whatever is happening now, all the repercussions of this over time. I felt a little weak for admitting it, a little shy and a little odd for saying it out loud. But mind you, I'm not really a raving socialite. I just really do appreciate the kind of interactions, ordinary kind of interactions with people that happen in other places besides just screens. And I still experience this loss. I can't really express it any better way than I am trying to do right now. I felt a little resonance in the meeting with what I was saying. This one woman seemed to identify a little bit with what I was saying. And then she went on to some political diatribe that seemed very distant from the emotions I was trying to express. And then that started a whole pattern of routinized kind of interactions, and we lost the moment. Now, of course, I'm not suggesting that we do anything different than we're doing right now about masking or distancing ourselves and being cautious about reopening right now. There have to be places, however, where we acknowledge the experiences that we're having while they are occurring. They have to be places, whether they're kitchen tables or congregations or other places, where we are present to our own and to others' actual experiences. Let's face it, we are overwhelmed. It's not so profound of a statement to say, but when I read from those who have dealt with overwhelm in kind of extraordinary ways on a daily basis, school shootings and child abductions and massacres and other things. People like Laura Van Denute Lipsky, who wrote the book, An Age of Overwhelm, I recognize that they're using a measuring stick for overwhelm that is not akin to my own experience. And they're saying that we are not in just a moment of overwhelm, we are in an age of overwhelm. When you add it all up, I'm realizing that we're encountering a much larger phenomenon than just present circumstances. I don't really have to enumerate all of these. However, I'm finding that I want to turn my attention not just to what's gonna get me through the day, not to what's just gonna get me through this immediate situation, but I wanna turn my attention and I wanna turn our conversation today towards strategies for the long haul. And it might help be helpful for me to try to illustrate what I'm talking about. So, I have a little prop here. I'm gonna hold it up to the camera so you can see it. So, see this bowl of water? It's almost full. It has some water in it. And let this bowl represent for us all the kinds of stresses and strains, traumas and pains and experiences that each of us carry in our own life. Sometimes because of our life experiences, sometimes because of who we are and the particular society in which we live. The point is that to one degree or another, each of us is already showing up in the world with some accumulation of these pains and strains, stresses and distresses, harms and hurts that have not actually fully been processed or worked through or made sense of. As some say, we haven't metabolized or integrated these experiences into some new way of making sense or adapting to the world. Sometimes we have taken the painful, hurtful, unfortunate experiences of our lives and integrated them into a stronger sense of self. But the bowl can sometimes still be half full, and we're still each carrying something into this world as we show up. Now, I don't want to sound like I'm psychologizing our current situation, because we know that the sources of our pain are often external to us. They're social conditions, as in this pandemic, global conditions that are outside of us. But let this pitcher of water that I'm pouring into this bowl represent those external situations that add to our stresses and our distresses, our pain and our strains. And notice what happens as the bowl fills. Notice what happens. It begins to get very close to overflowing. There's only so much that we can actually take on. That, to me, is the experience of overwhelm. Some call trauma as a situation in which so much is coming to us at that we don't have a way of, at such a rate, that we don't have a way of managing or making sense of, metabolizing it in real time. And if more is added on top of what's already there, we are in a definite state of overwhelm. Right now, as individuals, as an society, I think we are definitely in what could be called a time or an age of overwhelm. Now, all of our ways of coping with overwhelm are not as helpful as other ways. Some of our ways are disassociating, like pretending it's not happening, separating ourselves from it, putting ourselves in our own bubble, not allowing ourselves to experience the emotions that we are experiencing, or making light of it, or looking only at one side of it, like in the example of my conversation with my colleagues. They were looking at the alone time, but not necessarily acknowledging the losses involved. I was looking at the losses, but maybe not at some of the benefits of this time in that particular conversation. There are ways of distracting ourselves. Did anyone say Netflix? Oh, I think that was me. There are ways that we distract ourselves. Each of us have our own ways of doing that. Meanwhile, our bodies and our spirits and our hearts are being burdened in ways and at rates that we cannot fully process. We become the tensions, the anxieties, the sleeplessness, the short-temperedness, the being over-agitatedness that can show up, sometimes even be blurted out in a moment's notice. Albert Camus, the French philosopher, expressed it this way. We all carry within us our places of exile, our crimes, our ravages, and our task is not to unleash them onto the world, it's to transform them within ourselves. All of our adamant words, all of our railings against, all of our pious platitudes about silver linings alone do not change the fact that we are actually in overwhelm. We are trying to process too much. We can't keep up. We as individuals and a society are also carrying burdens on top of burdens that are already there. So I have talked about this time oftentimes as a shift of consciousness, that we're prompted by the global and this global moment into a new way of being, and not just a new way of thinking. We're prompted at this time into a new way of acting, and not just a new way of thinking about our situation. We need to recognize that it's our practices and not just our thoughts that are going to carry us forward into what's next. So none of the best ideas make a difference unless we can translate them into practices. It's practices that actually help us metabolize and to process and to work through this overwhelm as it is going on, as we're going through it. There are practices that call us to be more present to our experience, and there are practices that take us away from our experiences, that absent us. At its best, a religious community calls us towards and supports us in and motivates us towards those capacities that allow us to engage rather than isolate, to change rather than abandon the real world, and to become more present rather than more absent. So Laura Van Denroot Lipsky, who I mentioned earlier, offers a group of practices that I want to share with you now. And she proposes that we can make some shifts even as we are experiencing trauma, even as we are experiencing overwhelm and all the various ways that it shows up for us. When we allow ourselves to become distracted, she says, we can focus on being more intentional. And so I'll be talking about that as we move through this. When we are disconnecting, we can take measures to be more present. When we find ourselves becoming attached, digging in, becoming more entrenched with our ideas or our understanding of how things should be, we can soften this by shifting to a place of curiosity. When we feel depleted, we can seek ways to bolster our stamina. We become the practices that we do. So when we practice distraction, we become our distraction. So what are the practices that can move us in the directions of shifting from distraction to more intention? Distractions are present in so many ways when we cope with overwhelm. So oftentimes what we do, our intention around distraction is to get our mind off of that which distracts us. So it can be a temporary relief, but it also has a long-term cost over time. So there are many ways that we do distractions. Social media, or the fear of missing out, that's FOMO, FOMO, for those of you who want to be hip in your language. We ruminate about the past, or we start doing future tripping, or we focus on some doomsday scenario, or we do what neuroscientists call this negativity bias, which is kind of built into us, and we're scanning for bad news, for danger all the time. We accumulate things, or our cynicism shows up, and we criticize others. James Baldwin said, "I imagine that one of the reasons people cling to their hates so stubbornly is because they sense that once hate is gone, they will be forced to deal with pain." So what would the practice of intentionality be over and against the tendency towards distraction? It means deepening our awareness of what we're doing when we are practicing distraction, and then asking ourselves, is this edifying? Is this eroding me? Is it helpful or is it harmful? And perhaps we can also imagine ourselves recalibrating during the day, pausing briefly and asking ourselves, where am I? What state am I in right now? My state of distraction or cynicism? Where am I putting my focus? Am I also practicing gratitude this day? So practicing being intentional means asking, is what I'm doing aligned with what I really value for myself, for others, and for the world? It means also kind of protecting your morning, starting with practices that allow you to start in the right way with a sense of intention for the day. It means being gentle and trying to manage the volume and the intensity of distractions and to control that which you can. There's no rule in the universe that says we have to have the news blaring in the background all the time, all day long. We can make some adjustments to those things. Vandermoot Lipsky says that we can make these shifts, and she uses this metaphor. It's like tuning a guitar string. If we tighten it too much, it will break. If it's too loose, it won't play. So we have to find our own way of managing this dimension between intentionality and distraction. What about this practice of disconnecting that we might not even be aware of is a practice for us? We all know that in spite of all of its benefits, technology and gadgets also sometimes cause us to feel less connected rather than more connected. Why? Because our body and our mind and our spirit can only take so much. So we disconnect. It's a way of getting through. The practice of disconnecting often means we become numb. We check out. We don't necessarily bring our best self or our present self to situations. When distracted, we're a sliver of what we actually can be. Through the practice of being present, all of us have ways of doing this. I'll just name a few. Maybe it means detoxing now and then from screens or sugar. Not forever, but for periods of time, so we get to know who we are without those constant ways of disconnecting from our real experience and our own energy. May it mean slowing ourselves down when we're tempted to rush ahead, rather than just succumbing to our scanning of the environment for danger. Maybe we can sit back and recognize what benefit, what good things are happening as well. It means actually becoming obviously more aware to the natural rhythms of our own breathing and of nature and the healing power of nature that is always there to bring its own calm and its own connection to us. The practice of becoming attached to digging in or becoming more entrenched is another tendency that happens when we're in overwhelm. Oftentimes, we don't realize when we're in overwhelm how becoming attached to our emotions or our thoughts can also limit our capacity to actually change the situation, to take in new information or new perspective. We clench our teeth. We imagine. We become like the dog who grasps the bone or the stick with their teeth, and when we try to take it away, it's hard to let go. Many of us are grasping or attaching or entrenched to particular ideas or emotions or ways of being. And we become animated sometimes in a way that's really not natural to the actual situation. So don't get me wrong, this is really a time of overwhelm, and outrage is a way to deal with it. But the danger is that all we have is an outrage, and the ways that might spill over might be ways of demotivating ourselves or others. We need to be able to dissolve our attachment, being open to, using another musical metaphor, being open to all the notes in an octave, not just the particular ones of our own experiences, the ones that we tend to repeat. When grasping, we fixate the notes on a familiar scale. And when rejecting, we don't even hear the familiar notes that are also there. Only when we let the music wash over us and through us does it take care of itself. So one of the antidotes to grasping, to being attached, to digging in, is to practice curiosity. When we find ourselves being attached to a particular point of view, oftentimes we're limiting our vision rather than using our peripheral vision. What would it be like to practice being more curious? It would mean asking more questions and practicing less judgments. It may mean softening our eyes and unclenching our teeth and allowing ourselves to be with the wisdom of our own senses. So we obviously have to be both curious and discerning. We can't just be curious without having some kind of discernment, and that's the balance. The other tendency in times of overwhelm is to move to depletion. I suspect many of us have become so accustomed to depletion that we don't even recognize that there's something else possible. But there are many ways that we can do things differently. One practice that I've asked people sometimes to do is to get two sets of note cards, two different colors. And during the day, write down on one set, one color, perhaps, those things that deplete you. On the other set, those things that energize you. And over the course of a week after a week, to kind of look at the cluster there and ask yourself, what are the things that energize me? What are the things that deplete me? So Emma Goldman said, if I can't dance, I don't want to be part of your revolution. Well, we're not sure she actually said this, but we do know in her book, when her autobiography, she said she went to a dance once and one of her activist friends derided her for dancing so freely and so fervently at that dance. And she thought to herself, if being involved in activism means I have to give up joy, I have to give up dance, I don't know that this activism is really worth it. So of course, we'll never achieve not being distracted or disconnected. We'll never achieve having no sense of attachment or no sense of depletion. These go with the territory of being human. But my friends, in a time in which we are experiencing more overwhelm, we don't want to show up more distracted, more dissociated, more disconnected, more attached to things, and more depleted. It doesn't serve us as individuals. It doesn't serve us as a congregation or a society. These states make us ripe for a takeover by aliens. I was just checking your hearing then, what I meant, just to see if you were listening. They make us ripe for alienation from ourselves when we should be more connected. This is really a time of awakening. It's a time in which we can begin to awaken ourselves in the moment in new ways. I believe that our Unitarian Universalist principles actually become alive when we translate them into practices and not just shellac them as a set of noble ideas. So if we act in ways that nurture the practices that affirm the inherent worth and dignity of every person, then we're disciplining our practices in a particular direction. And through our practices and not just our ideas alone, we are creating the banks on the side of a river in which our lives can flow in some new directions. So I have a suggestion. Rather than when we encounter one another, rather than asking one another, how are you doing? I'm going to suggest that we ask, what are you doing to stay more intentional? Let's just say that out loud right now. What are you doing to stay more intentional? Rather than asking, how are you doing? Maybe we can say, what are you doing to be more present? What are you doing to be more present? Rather than say, how are you doing? Say, what are you doing to stay curious? Rather than asking, how are you doing? We can ask, what are you doing to building more stamina for the long haul? This, my friends, I think are the practices that we need to engage in this time of overwhelm. This brings forth more possibility and more potential for us, for those we love, for this world that we care about. So may it be. Amen.